Good morning. If you would, grab a Bible. Let's turn to the book of Acts, chapter 16. Acts 16 is where we'll be spending all of our time for this part of our worship this morning. Acts 16. It is good to see you and good to be up here in front of you. This has been a long time coming for me, and I just want to say a few words before I get started. First of all, Sarah wanted me to be sure and tell you, and I wanted to say this too, how much our family appreciates the incredibly warm welcome that you guys have given us since we've been here, and we've been able to kind of be worshiping with you for a couple of weeks, and it has just been a treat and a blessing, and we appreciate you so much. We're excited about the work, excited to be here, and I've been able to have a couple of weeks of figuring out all the problems that all of you have so that now I know what to preach about. No, we're just so thrilled to be with you. And I'm excited to be here. I want to say something, too. We have people visiting with us this morning. We're so excited that you're here, that you've chosen to be with us. We want to get to know you. We're excited to have you with us, to meet you. So please stick around. Let us talk with you and get to know you a little bit before you head out. Acts chapter 16. I want to begin just by reading here, verse 25. Acts 16 and verse 25. It says, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. And suddenly there was a great earthquake, so that the foundations of the prison were shaken. And immediately all the doors were opened, and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. But Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Have you ever wondered what makes people change? Here the jailer is going about his job. It's a normal day. It's an everyday occurrence for him to lock people up in the jail and go home. And yet this day will be different. On this day, his life will change forever, or we might say this night. His life will change forever. That what begins as normal procedure is then going to proceed to an incredible earthquake, a suicide attempt, his life flashing before his eyes, and then change for himself and his whole family that will change the rest of his life. The gospel is a message of change. It is a message that says, Jesus has come to earth, he is God's son, he is king, and now we repent and we change to conform our lives to him so that we have hope of eternal life. Salvation and change now in hopes of salvation and change later. But have you ever wondered why it is that some people respond to that life-changing message and other people don't? Or some people take years and years of hearing that gospel message before they'll finally do something about it, and other people immediately do it. That some people have tons and tons of questions that they have to work through over a long period of time, and then some people just come in and say, "What do I need to do to be saved?" Falling down, trembling. What's the difference? Maybe we should just talk about ourselves. Have you ever had a change that you knew you needed to make, but you just stubbornly refused to make? You knew what you should do, and yet you waited, and you hemmed and hawed, and you made excuses. What was it that pushed you over the edge? That's what I want us to think about for a few minutes this morning. The writer Malcolm Gladwell popularized the phrase, the tipping point. And the idea of the tipping point in Gladwell's thinking is that there is something in a movement that causes words. The tipping point is the moment of critical mass, the threshold, the boiling point. And what I want to do is talk about the Philippian jailer, because something this night brought him to the tipping point where he decided now is the time and I'm going to change now. The same hour of the night, all his life is going to change. And so I want us to think about ourselves and how we change, and also the people in our lives, and how we're going to have opportunities to help others change and bring them to the tipping point for themselves. So let's set our feet here in Acts 16. This is the end of a long day for Paul and Silas. They are in Macedonia, the Macedonian city of Philippi. And they came to Macedonia because Paul had a dream in which a man from Macedonia said, "Come over and help us." But frankly, it hasn't been going great. They get to Philippi, and Paul's normal procedure when you come to a city is to go into the synagogue and preach in the synagogue first, where the Jews are, and then eventually he'll get run out of the synagogue and go to the Gentiles. The problem is there don't seem to be enough Jews in Philippi to have a synagogue. So instead, they are resigned to going down to the river where a group of women are praying. And there they meet Lydia, and they baptize Lydia and her household. But after that, things just seem to be moving slowly. In fact, the only action we read about happening in Philippi is that there is this demon-possessed girl following them around, and Paul becomes so annoyed. The text says he is greatly annoyed, which I think is one of those biblical understatements. He's so annoyed that he casts the demon out of the girl. Haven't you ever been that annoyed? Did you cast out someone's demon? Okay, that's something that Paul had a special gift to do, but he casts out the demon, and so this girl's owners are angry because they make money off her fortune-telling, and so they get them into trouble. And that's where our story picks up, Acts 16 and verse 20. Acts 16 and verse 20, it says, "When they had brought them to the magistrates, they said, 'These men are Jews, and they are disturbing our city. They advocate customs that are not lawful for us as Romans to accept or practice.'" So those are the accusations. They're Jews, they're disturbing the city, they're advocating bad customs. That's probably, I want you to note this, that's probably all that the jailer knows about these men, is that they are accused of not just being Jews, but also of preaching things that are upsetting and shouldn't be preached. Verse 22, "The crowd joined in attacking them, and the magistrates tore the garments off them and gave orders to beat them with rods. And when they had inflicted many blows upon them, they threw them into prison, ordering the jailer to keep them safely. Having received this order, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks." So they are, the text says, stripped. They are beaten severely. Remember, the Jews had a rule that we're only going to beat them 40 times, 40 lashes. But the Romans had no such rule. They would beat as long as they wanted to beat. So they are beaten severely, and then they are jailed, put in the stocks, and in the inner prison. We would call it maximum security. And here they sit. And so the jailer comes into our story because the jailer receives them and receives this order. We've got some bad criminals here. You need to watch out. And that's where our story picks up with the jailer. So the question we're asking is, what makes people change? And the first thing I want to point out from this text is that circumstances can shift with people. So in verse 24, it says, "The jailer received this order and put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks." So he's just doing his job here. He puts them in the maximum security wing, puts their feet in the stocks. Usually this was uncomfortable. Remember, these men have bleeding wounds, which we're going to find out a little later, have not been tended to at all. And yet he says, no, we've got to get them in the position of the most hardened criminals. So how did they respond? Verse 25, "About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them." So somehow these two men are praying and singing hymns. We have some evidence that in ancient Roman jails, sometimes they would bring all of the prisoners into one room at night so that you could get them all safe there, and you could go and the jailer can leave the premises and know that everybody's safe. Of course, that would explain a lot about our story, like how everybody can hear them. And it would also explain why they're all together when Paul says that everybody is safe here in a minute. Verse 26, "And suddenly there was a great earthquake so that the foundations of the prison were shaken, and immediately all the doors were open and everyone's bonds were unfastened. When the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped." So an earthquake rattles the foundations of the prison. The doors are open, their bonds are loosened. That's a very specific kind of earthquake, by the way, that gets everybody's bonds loosed as well. Now, there is a possibility that the jailer's home adjoins the jail, okay, because it says in the text that the jailer was wakened from sleep. I don't know that the jailer was just asleep on the job. It's likely that he is right next door, especially considering what we're going to read later in the story. So perhaps he locks everything up, goes home, is asleep, feels the earthquake, and thinks what any jailer would think, oh, no. Hope everything's okay at the jail. He goes over to the jail, and what does he find? All the doors are open. This is a nightmare. And so, consider what goes through this man's head in that moment. In verse 27, it says he was supposed that the prisoners had escaped. That's what he thinks, which means his job is done, his life is over. He draws his sword to kill himself. Now, verse 28, Paul cried with a loud voice, "Do not harm yourself, for we are all here." And the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas, and he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" So Paul says, don't worry, we're all here, which how could Paul have known that? Probably they were all there together. And so the man rushes in, trembling, falls down, asking what he must do to be saved. Now, please note how much has changed from him receiving the prisoners and locking them up to now rushing into them, trembling, asking, "What must I do to be saved?" falling down in front of them. But what happens here, what changes, is not that the jailer has heard lots and lots of gospel sermons. And, you know, he just decided, you know what, it's time. I've heard enough, I believe in Jesus, I'm ready. No, that's nothing. We don't know anything that he had heard about Jesus. We'll talk more about what his question means here in a minute. But we don't know that he heard anything about Jesus. What changed for the jailer was an earthquake and his life flashing before his eyes. His circumstances changed. Caleb read for us the story of the prodigal son. The prodigal son is just like this. What changes with the prodigal son? It says, when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country. So it wasn't that he was sitting around saying, you know, I really shouldn't have done that to my dad where I took all the money and left. No, there was a famine. So there wasn't a lot of food, and he began to be in need. And then it says he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, by the way, I just love that phrase, when he came to himself, it kind of indicates that he was a little crazy before this, and then he kind of came to his senses. And he woke up, and he said, you know what, I need to do something. So he says, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread? I perish here with hunger. I'll arise and go to my father. Sometimes what we need is for circumstances to hit us upside the head so that we realize, I need to do something. I need to change something. I need to come to myself. Now, I am not saying that we can't make changes until our circumstances go sour. But I am saying that often, change doesn't feel urgent until circumstances make it urgent. So we feel it in a different way. Now, that seems particularly true. I know this isn't our jailer, but let me just say this. That seems particularly true with wealth. That when we have money, we tend to not worry too much about other things. We tend to get complacent when we have money. Do you remember how Jesus describes the church at Laodicea in Revelation 3? Where they said, I have become rich and am wealthy and have need of nothing. I'm good because I have what I want. Jesus says, well, you don't realize that you're wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Kind of off on that assessment. But instead, that's what wealth does. Remember when Moses is challenging the people before they go into the promised land? And he says, you're going to go in and you're going to have all these cisterns that you didn't dig and vineyards that you didn't plant. Just beware that you don't forget the Lord. When you have so much, you have everything you need. There is that tendency in us to say, you know what, I'm good. I got what I need. But sometimes when circumstances change, that's when we wake up. The one that really sticks out to me is when King Belshazzar is sitting there toasting to his gods with cups that come from the temple of Jehovah, and suddenly there's a hand writing on the wall, and it says his knees started knocking together. Think there was some change there? Now, I know he didn't go all the way, but let me tell you, some disposition changes when circumstances change. Circumstances shifting just seems to puncture our pride a little bit. Say, maybe I don't have everything figured out. Maybe I'm wrong about something. Maybe I see my need again. So, when people you know seem resistant to the gospel, just remember, circumstances can change. This is not the end of the story. In fact, I might just say it this way. There are little personal earthquakes happening in the lives of the people you and I know. Little earthquakes shaking things up. You and I both know people who are losing their jobs, who are struggling in their marriages, who are falling apart mentally, whose health is not good. There are earthquakes shaking them. And so it might be that those are openings to show our care for them, but it might also be that they are openings for the gospel. Because circumstances changing is one of the things that makes people change. The second thing you see in this story is that needs emerge. You see, when we get knocked off center, we start seeing life differently. Look at what the jailer does. Look at verse 27 with me of Acts 16. It says, when the jailer woke and saw that the prison doors were open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself, supposing that the prisoners had escaped. Now, the jailer went to work today expecting not to kill himself. And yet things have changed, and suddenly he is thinking in a different way. He has that gut punch moment where he looks and sees everything has fallen to pieces and the tragic reach for the sword. And so, verse 29, the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? See, in this moment, the man begins to think about how much he has to lose. His life. He has nearly lost his life. And in that moment, we're just a little more open to things being different than what they are. We are thinking on a different level. Needs come to the fore. What is really important in life? Have you ever had a moment where you thought you might die? And what flashes through your head in moments like those? Maybe there's a car that's careening out of control. Maybe it's a sickness you don't know if you're going to get better from. Whatever it may be, what matters to you in those moments? It's not the silly things, the simple things. It is the needs of your heart and life. Needs emerge. And so for this man, he begins to ask deeper questions. Things matter more now that didn't matter before. Before, it was about doing my job. It was an ordinary day. Now it's about, what must I do to be saved? Something has changed. I see this also in the rich young ruler who approaches Jesus, and it says, all these things, all these commands Jesus said to keep, all these things I've kept, what do I still lack? In the other accounts, Jesus says, you lack one thing, sell all you have and give to the poor. But you hear what he's saying? He's saying, I feel it. Something's not right. And I'm here, I'm bowing down before you to try to figure out what's the problem. That's a need question. Now, I know the rich young ruler doesn't respond well to that. But what I am saying is, this is a moment when the iron is hot for change. It doesn't mean that we'll necessarily change, but it does mean we've at least got the real issues on the table. This is what the big deal is. And Jesus tells him, here's the real issue. It's your money. You got to get rid of it because it's an idol to you, and you got to move on. But one way or another, we got to get those issues on the table. So when a man comes and says, what must I do to be saved? That's a deeper question than, are you guys doing okay here in the back part of the prison? Needs have emerged. And so he begins to wonder, who are these guys? Maybe I'll go ask them the questions of my heart. Something that was merely intellectual before now becomes a need. I will say it this way. I can tell you that you need something. But until you feel it and embrace it and grapple with it, it's extremely unlikely that you will change. There is a moment when needs emerge, and suddenly we don't have to argue about it. Instead, someone will just say, help me. And that leads us to the next part, which is that answers are sought. Look at what happens in verse 29. In verse 29, it says, the jailer called for lights and rushed in, and trembling with fear, he fell down before Paul and Silas. Then he brought them out and said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? He has a burning question, and he takes it to these men. When we seek answers, the questions that plague us, that bring us to other people, those are peculiarly personal questions. I have discovered this in dealing with and working with people over the years. Everybody's questions are different. And the draw of people, what brings people to Jesus, is different for every person. It's different for you than it is for me. I'm not talking about salvation. I'm talking about what is particularly appealing and what is particularly challenging about Jesus is different for each one. And so what that means is sometimes it's hard to answer all the questions in a setting like this. And even the jailer gets some very personal attention to answer his very personal question. I doubt that the jailer said, you know what, I want to talk to Paul and Silas because I heard that sermon they preached. You know, the one, it was about when you almost lose your job and you almost lose your life, you need Jesus. That wasn't the sermon. He didn't know that. Instead, he just comes with a question, and they are ready to answer. So sometimes there are very specific things that need to be dealt with as we talk about change. When John the Baptist has a big crowd, different segments of the crowd ask him, what do we do? The tax collectors say, what do we do? The soldiers say, what do we do? And John answers each one of them individually. And sometimes we come asking the specific questions of our hearts. Questions like, how do I beat pornography? How do I get out of this cycle of debt? How do I save my marriage? How do I overcome this addiction? And what I want you to see from the jailer is that this is not, hey, let's just discuss this issue. I've got some intellectual questions. Instead, they fall down trembling and they say, I've got to do something about this now. I need change. I need help. I need answers. So what is the jailer's question? He asks in verse 30, sirs, what must I do to be saved? I am deeply curious as to what he means. I suspect if we know nothing more about this man's background than what we read in the text, then he is a Gentile, possibly a retired Roman soldier who is doing this job as sort of a pension. I suspect he fears whatever God must have caused this earthquake. I suspect he wants to know how to pacify that God because he knows he has just saved his skin and just barely. And so he is terrified about forces he cannot control. Now, I say that to say, sometimes we don't even know the real depth of our needs or our questions. And so we come and we ask the question, but we don't know how deep that iceberg goes down. And sometimes people will come to us and ask questions, and the answers are not surface answers. You want to talk to somebody about how to beat pornography. You want to talk to somebody about how to save a marriage. Those are answers I can't give you in 5 minutes. There's work to be done. There is a depth to that. And in the same way, what must I do to be saved? Paul says, oh, I know the answer to that question, but it might not be what you're thinking. There might be a whole dimension you have not thought about. And yet he takes them at that moment and says, let me tell you about the one who can really save you. You might not even know what saving means. But there is something else here. Why does he seek answers from Paul and Silas? It's hard to know exactly what the jailer knew about Paul and Silas. They were obviously in his prison. He knew the accusations against them. He probably heard their prayers and songs. And then he knows that Paul cried out to him, hey, we're all here, don't hurt yourself. But surely, this jailer had seen tons of prisoners. And when you start thinking about, well, what would a jailer hear from prisoners about their prison sentences? You've probably got a whole bunch of prisoners who say, you know what, I'm innocent. This is unfair. I'm being treated wrongly. And then maybe you have a few who accept their fate and they're, you know, they're not happy, but they're okay. But the idea that there would be prisoners who were joyful after being beaten and thrown into the inner prison, that's got to make an impression. Their reaction earns them an audience. Can I say that again? Their reaction earns them an audience with him. If they spent the night complaining and bemoaning their treatment, you know, what about my rights? What about getting back at them? I want my revenge. If they had spent the evening talking about how no Roman should ever be treated this way, I'm going to have their jobs for this. Do you think the jailer would have come to them? What happens here is that they earn an audience by their reaction to adversity and unfairness, and by their refusal to seek revenge. So the question that raises for me is, how is my reaction to adverse circumstances I go through earning me an audience with the people around me? Or are they just going to hear, well, Jacob, he complains about everything. I've got a problem. He'll probably complain about that too. Or do they see something different, a different spirit, a connection to someone different and deeper and better? One of the most powerful things you and I can do is position ourselves so that when the people we know and love have questions like this man, they know who to come to. They know that's a person I could ask the questions of my heart. And so then, lives change. Look at verse 30 with me. In verse 30, then he brought them out and said, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" And they said, "Believe in the Lord Jesus, and you will be saved, you and your household." And they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all who were in his house. So what the man needs, Paul knows, is Jesus. But he doesn't know the first thing about Jesus. So it says he spoke the word of the Lord. He told him about Jesus, and he preaches to him and his household. Again, I suspect that the house probably adjoins the jail, so he brings them out of the jail and into his house. Things are already changing for the man, aren't they? If you're a jailer, that's probably rule number one, don't bring the prisoners in your home, right? Okay, but here he does. He brings them in his home. He lets them talk to his family and tell them about Jesus. Verse 33. And he took them the same hour of the night and washed their wounds, and he was baptized at once, he and all his family. Now that just reveals to us that they have been sitting with their bloody wounds in the jail all day, and yet he takes them and washes their wounds, which is a way he is undoing what he has done to them. He was a part of the whole system that beat them and imprisoned them, and now he says, I want to make sure that in whatever way I can, I am showing that I am sorry for that. But then the rest of verse 33 says that same hour of the night, he and his family were baptized at once. Right then, of course, they're at the water. They're washing wounds. See, here's water. What keeps me from being baptized? And so here's what I want you to see, though. The iron is hot. He's thinking about it. His family is thinking about it. The water is right here. Why not? And so that same hour of the night, I mean, we're talking well after midnight now, they decide to be baptized into Christ. In verse 34, then he brought them up to his house and set food before them, and he rejoiced along with his entire household that he had believed in God. I love this. This is one of my favorite things about preaching, about being a Christian, is the unplanned, middle of the night, rush to the baptistry, the joy, the hugs, and here you've got, well, hey, why don't we eat? I wonder what time it was. I'm trying to figure out what time it was. I wonder how long it took all this to happen. The earthquake happened around midnight. Are we talking 3 a.m.? Are we talking breakfast? Is it 5 or 6 now? I don't know. They don't care because it says they rejoiced having believed in God with his whole household. That's what Luke says is the whole summation. He has now believed in God. He asked the question. He got the answer. He responded to the answer. His life has changed. All in one night. Now, there are still major decisions to make. He's still got to figure out what is following Jesus going to look like in his job. What's it going to mean when he teaches his family? He's got more to learn. But something big has happened this night. So here's my point. I believe that this jailer is sort of a shortened version of a whole style of conversion and change. That is, this is not the only way people change. But it is a way where suddenly people, due to their circumstances or people in their lives or a message they hear, shift and begin to listen and respond and change. And God, this is the cool part, God has a knack for having his people on the ground ready to receive those people and help them. Having Paul and Silas just happening to be in that man's jail at the same time where there just happens to be an earthquake that night. It all just happened to work out just so. Just like there's a man who is traveling along the road in his chariot. Just so happens that Philip comes upon the chariot and begins to talk to him about what he's reading in Isaiah. God has a knack for bringing people together at the right moment so that when the iron is hot, there are God's people there to say, let me help you go all the way and change your life. Well, that leaves me with a couple of questions. And I want to offer these to you, and the lesson will be yours. First, it makes me ask the question, what changes am I resisting? So if you're a believer already, you put your faith in Jesus. You have made the change that we've read about from this man, the jailer. But there are some aftershocks after that initial earthquake. There are other changes that need to be made, recalibrations that we need to do. So the question is, Do you have some sins that you need to address? Problems that you know you need to deal with in your life? Confessions to make? Teachings to embrace? People that you need to talk to? Forgiveness that you need to offer? Something you need to do? My suspicion is most of us have something. And I don't need to go through the whole list. You know what it is for you. And so we resist and we kind of lock in and we have our excuses and our reasons. And if somebody brings it up, we'll say, oh, no, I don't need to do that. Here are the 10 reasons why I don't need to do that. But deep down, we know there's a change that needs to happen and I am resisting it. What will it take to tip you over into full obedience? Is it something where we're going to have to wait for the circumstances to move? We're going to have to wait for bad things to happen before we wake up? Or can we just say, you know, I'm going to quit fighting God. I'm going to give in. I'm going to do what I know the Lord wants me to do. Don't fight God. Don't kick against the goads. Make yourself fully obedient. But we might have people in our audience today who are not believers. My question is, what will it take for you? Is it possible that some of your circumstances are shifting right now that have led to you being in this building, listening to this lesson? Could it be that something is changing in your life already and that you need to respond to the call of God on your life, just like this man? Could it be that you're beginning to wonder and see, I need some things that I'm not getting. I have questions I can't get answers to. I need to do something about this. What would it take to take you to the tipping point where you finally say, yes, yes, I will do what God calls me to do? Like the jailer, you need to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ. Like the jailer, you need to be baptized into Christ. Like the jailer, you need to continue to follow him from now on. Don't fight God. Don't resist the changes you know you need to make. The second question is, what people in my life is God bringing to the tipping point? Here is what I want you to use your imagination a little bit. I want you to think about the people in your circles, the people you talk to on a regular basis. Maybe it's people in your family. Maybe it's people that you go to school with or are your roommates, people you work with, people who are good friends, people who are your neighbors, the people in your circles. I want you to think about how, from time to time, they'll tell you, you know, I'm having a hard time with this. My mom has been sick. I'm worried about my job. Or they ask you a question. Hey, where do you go to church? Well, you know, I'm thinking about doing something different. I'm not sure I believe anymore. They begin to say things to you that indicate something is shifting, something is changing. Could it be that there are people who God is bringing to their tipping point, and somehow he is trying to include you in that process? Could it be that people asking you to pray for them, or people who are confiding in you, or people who are seeking your advice are really close? See, the issue is we tend to put people in boxes and say, well, that person would never obey the gospel. That person's not interested. But what we see in the jailer is that people change. Stuff happens in their lives, and suddenly they're different, and they're open. So, if I see that, how can I be God's man or woman on the ground in that situation, just to help them? Like Paul, to just receive them, to just say, here is what the gospel means, and here is what you need to do. What example can I set? What encouragement can I give? Keep your eyes open, because God is at work. So, what makes people change? Jesus makes people change. We are followers of Jesus because our lives have been changed by him, and we call others to the changes that he wants to make, to bring them to the tipping point so that you'll be not just almost, but altogether what we are, followers of Jesus, with hope of salvation now and in the life to come. If you need to come to him, we invite you to come to the front as we stand and sing to encourage you.
The Lord bless you.